Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello and welcome to MASHcast, the show that analyzes and celebrates, episode by episode, the greatest TV series of all time, MASH, which aired on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Corporal Captain Rob Kelly. And joining us this week in the VIP tent is big fan of the show, Lieutenant Tim English. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Rob. How you doing?
I'm doing great. It's nice to have you here.
It's good to be here.
So this is your first time on the show, and so, of course, I have to ask you, like, what's your history with MASH the series? When did you become a fan and stuff like that?
I didn't actually become a fan until quite recently, actually. I was born in 86, so I was born well after the show had been off the air. And I remember watching my grandmother watch the show on TV Land growing up, and I never really got into it with her. And it wasn't until after she passed that those emotions kind of came back to me. Of her watching the show. And then one day I was in Best Buy about 4 or 5 years ago, I think it was, and I actually found the DVD box set, and I just bought it, and since then I've been watching a couple episodes a day regularly.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Do you recall, did she ever talk to you about it, or you just saw that she watched it and it was clearly something that she enjoyed?
It was something that she enjoyed, and I never really kind of got into it while she was watching it, but just the kind of knowing the sheer history of what the show has been for other shows throughout the 80s and 90s, like Cheers and other shows like that. Knowing that history, I kind of began to get into it from that.
Now that you've had a chance to watch it kind of from beginning to end, do you have a particular kind of favorite era or anything like that? Are there episodes you go back to more often than others?
There are. I actually love watching seasons 4, 5, and 6.
Ah, okay. Man after my own heart.
Yeah.
All right. Do you have a particular favorite characters?
I love Frank Burns. I don't know what it is about Frank, but I just love the interaction between him and Hawkeye. And also BJ, too. I tend to lean towards BJ a little more because those are the first episodes I actually remember watching.
Okay.
So, I mean, it's nothing against the character of Trapper. It's just that my introduction to the series was with BJ.
All right. Well, okay. Well, again, that's great. Again, thank you for being here. So the episode we're here to talk about is from season 2, of course, episode 32, The Trial of Henry Blake. The original air date is November 3rd, 1973, written by McLean Stevenson. We'll talk about that in a moment. Directed by Don Weiss. Henry and Radar, dressed up in their finest outfits, leave on a trip to HQ, but they don't say why. Meanwhile, Frank is walking around with a nasty grin on his face, and when Hawkeye and Trapper mouth off to him, he warns them that he might soon be in charge, so they better knock it off. At HQ, we see why Henry and Radar are there. Henry is on trial after charges were filed by Frank and Hot Lips. The trial is led by General Mitchell, Robert F. Simon. Examples of Henry's supposed lack of leadership are shown, like when he was the announcer for a race involving doctors pushing nurses on gurneys, or when he allowed Radar to hawk style-right wingtip shoes to everyone in camp, or the time when, under Henry's command, Klinger almost went AWOL via a hang glider that he hoped would sail him out of Korea. Henry doesn't deny these events, but says it doesn't mean the 477th isn't doing its duty. General Mitchell is unimpressed and places Henry under arrest. He tells Henry that he should have Corporal O'Reilly head back to camp to collect material to defend himself against the most serious of these charges, providing aid and comfort to the enemy. Radar makes it back and tells Hawkeye and Trapper what's happened. They plan to prepare a defense, but Frank has them arrested and placed in a tent with just their boxer shorts on. They get Klinger to drug the MP guarding them, allowing them to escape and head off to HQ. In the meantime, Henry is accused of providing supplies to Meg Craddy, a nurse who lives and operates deep inside North Korea, but who doesn't ask people's politics when they need help. Henry, again, doesn't deny the charges. General Mitchell asks Henry why he shouldn't be found guilty, and Henry simply offers, "I was only trying to help." Hawkeye, Trapper, and Radar arrive, along with Meg Craddy, played by Hope Summers. Nurse Craddy gives a forceful speech to General Mitchell and the rest, and as an example, has brought along a young pregnant woman who was alive because of Henry Blake's generosity. She says Henry is a good, decent man who just wants to help, which is more than I can say for interview high-priced bellhops. Henry then makes a speech of his own, admitting he is guilty, but not of giving aid to the enemy. He tried to do the human thing and help people in need. He says he didn't deprive the wounded kids of one thing. Frank and Hot Lips also arrive, and they refuse to drop the charges, even after General Mitchell suggests there isn't much of a case. This leads Hawkeye to show Frank, quote, some new evidence, which causes Frank to drop the charges immediately. They storm out, and Henry asks what this new evidence is. It's a note, which Radar reads aloud, to Mrs. Burns, telling her the sad news of her husband, whom she is so proud of, that he is frequently out of uniform, and with whom. The trial is over, Henry is free, and they all return home. Later, General Mitchell comes by to see the 477th in person, and everyone is there, in formation, wearing style right wingtip shoes. So, all right, Tim, why did you want to talk about this one? I mean, this is a great episode, but why did you want to talk about this one?
This episode kind of reached out to me on a couple different levels because, in my opinion, this is kind of different from where the series kind of went as far as directional from here, because this is one of the first episodes that I can remember that we don't actually see them doing medical stuff. But also, I think McLean Stevenson was so completely underrated as an actor.
Absolutely true.
And knowing that he actually wrote this episode, correct me if I'm wrong, he's credited with just writing this episode. He's credited with helping with the Army-Navy game, but this is the only episode that I can remember that he's actually written.
Right. He wrote the plot of Army-Navy game, but this one, he is the only credited writer for this episode, yeah.
And you could tell from beginning to end that this is just Henry all over it. And I actually love that about this episode.
Yeah, I mean, it's really pretty shocking that McLean Stevenson had such facility as a writer. I mean, I said last year for MASHcast that I thought the Army-Navy game is my favorite episode of season one. And this episode is really, really good. And so it's kind of a shame that Stevenson didn't either get a chance or didn't bother to write more episodes, because, I mean, he clearly knew how to do it. I mean, this is a great episode where it's got tons of laughs, but a real great dramatic spine to it, which I think is wonderful. And you can't blame the guy for writing an episode about himself. MASH writers tended to do that. There are episodes written by Mike Farrell where he focuses on BJ. I mean, of course, that's the character you know the most. But it also makes a lot of sense that all of this stuff that Henry does – which is very anti-Army, would at some point come back to bite him in the ass and get him in trouble. So it makes sense dramatically. I mean, it's a very impressive episode.
There's a few things that are in this episode, too, that also stood out to me that I want to touch base on. But some of the historical inaccuracies with the math based upon this episode, that was another thing that really stood out to me. And I know, you know, back in the 70s, it wasn't this whole thing of, you know, everything needs to be in order. People weren't dissecting episodes like we do now.
Right, yeah.
So there's some things that also kind of drove me a little crazy about the episode that I think are just mind-boggling, and I really drawn to it. If we go and talk about the end of the episode where Frank is in this makeshift courtroom and he's talking about how his family came to America in 1927.
Yeah.
I'm just sitting there thinking to myself, you know, that was 24 years before the Korean conflict.
That line makes no sense.
Meaning Frank would have had to have been at least 18 years old at the time that his family came to America. Number one, where's Frank's accent? Unless he came in from Canada. But to mathematically see Frank coming to America in 1927 just doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't.
That drove me absolutely nuts when I actually kind of sat down and did the math on that.
Yeah, even with the most generous, assumption of how young Frank Burns is, that means he was not born in America. What the hell is his country club going to think when they find that out? Yeah, that makes no sense at all.
Yep. And it's possible for Larry Linville's story, because Linville wasn't born until 36.
Right.
But it just didn't make sense, and it drove me crazy. I don't know why, but it just did.
That's the kind of thing where I feel as though, you just said, they probably weren't figuring that people were paying this close attention. I'm guessing that there are – it's hard to explain, but it's like there are numbers that are funnier than other numbers for some reason. I can't put you just know it in your head. And I'm guessing that when the writers did it, there was something about the way Linville could say 1927, which of course you just know sort of in your gut. That's not that long ago, and he's crowing about it. I mean, obviously he could have said my family came to this country in 1917, and that would still be absurd for Frank to be pulling this kind of I'm an American more than other people nonsense. But somehow 1917 isn't as funny as 1927. So I guess they just went with it, even though clearly anybody listening was like, wait, this makes no sense, Frank.
Also, one of the other things that also kind of drove me a little crazy about that scene is how Hawkeye and Trapper are speaking to General Mitchell and the two majors on his side. What makes them think that they can actually get away with speaking like that to the court?
Mm-hmm.
It, it's just, it really kind of, you wouldn't see that in an army base, I think.
Right. I mean, you have to kind of play fast and loose a little with that Hawkeye and Trapper are such all-stars in terms of their surgical skills that they get away with things that hardly anybody would be able to get away with. And with this episode is the debut of General Mitchell, the beginning of this character. And they would show very quickly on that he was actually, as generals go, not too bad. And you know, he would appear in a couple more episodes after this, and we would see he had kind of had a soft side. I mean, we'll get to it in a minute, but when we talk about the favorite joke of this episode, my favorite joke is a line from General Clayton. So he had kind of a warm side. And while we're on the subject, I mentioned that General Mitchell was played by Robert F. Simon, and he died in 1992. He had a really great career. He was in The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, Operation Petticoat, a great movie with James Mason called Bigger Than Life. He was in Where the Sidewalk Ends with Gene Tierney, which Dr. Ange and I covered on the Film and Water podcast. But of course, most of us nerds know him from his number one genre credit, which was playing J. Jonah Jameson on the Amazing Spider-Man TV series. So that's his big claim to fame. But he had a kind of – he's real blustery here. And of course, he's in his – you know, he's in dress uniform, and he's putting Henry on trial. So he seems very stern. But he did have a kind of warmth to him that I think really worked well for the character. And again, when he comes back, he's even nicer. But he had that very serious kind of face. And so he was really kind of the perfect general. I wish he had lasted longer. He doesn't make that many appearances before MASH basically got rid of any of the recurring general characters. This is sort of the last of the group, which is too bad because I like him here a lot.
He was only in two other episodes.
Right.
The Incubator and Officers Only.
Right.
Which are also two very good episodes.
Yes. Yeah. He's really great. He's one of those, you know, he's just one of those great character actors who just have like a very sort of serious face and could do a lot of different things. And so, yeah, I like him here a lot. I think he's a lot of fun. And I love the setup of this episode and that, of course, so much of it is our flashbacks. Because we're hearing all these things about what Henry's done, and there's the gurney race where the girls are on they're being pushed through the race, and even Henry, I love Henry affects that announcer voice. He's like Bouncing Betty, like he's doing something from an old timey radio, and even though he's real demure, like when the one nurse breaks the tape, she breaks the tape chest first.
Yes,
and he can't bring himself to say it. He's like she wins by I love him.
Yeah. The winner is Bouncing Betty. That was a great, great little cutback. And that was one of the things that really stood out to me about that episode is kind of being, if you look back at any of the flashbacks that might have done on other TV shows when they were talking about MASH, a lot of those cutscenes that they pieced together in use a lot of this episode, like Klinger with the hang glider the racing scene. I mean, I watch commercials or anything like that promoting MASH on TV Land or any of those channels, and they show Klinger with the hang glider and the big red bird with the fuzzy pink feet. And this is one of the quintessential episodes of the series in that regard, that it really takes a lot of popularity.
Well, that scene with Klinger and the hang glider, it is historic. Of course, it is probably MASH's first and only special effects shot, because clearly the shot of where Klinger is dangling from the hang glider, which makes me almost nauseous to look at because he's so high up and he's just hanging by his hands. You're supposed to lay in there. You're not supposed to dangle, and it's clearly a MASH shot. It's clearly matted over footage of the camp. So this is like their first special effects shot, which is, you know, probably not something that the MASH ever had to turn to the Fox effects crew to do. But I guess they wanted to spend a little extra money, and you've got that very silly shot of Klinger just sort of running in air as he's flying over the camp.
And the other thing, too, is MASH used in that scene. They use this, like, music that they never really did again. Before that, and it just kind of, to me, that music adding to that scene was, it fit the scene, but it didn't fit the show. Mm-hmm. And I think it was a little out of MASH's realm to add that music, because it was like that typical 70s sitcom background music that kind of is supposed to project the comedy of the scene.
Yeah.
And it just, it fit for that scene, but I don't think it fit the TV show. I mean, in my opinion, other people might have you know, disagree with me, but I just don't think it fit.
As the show wore on, they would pull in a little about what kind of stuff they would use. They would get a little more controlled, and that's not the kind of music you could ever imagine in like a season 10 episode.
No,
you know, it would never work. But I mean, it's such an audacious, ridiculous thing to see him flying over there, and I like the repeating gag of where Hawkeye sees it and looks out of the corner of his eye, and then Trapper comes along, and of course they're out on the fringes of the camp making out with nurses, and he's mm-hmm. like, "What did you just? I saw a fuzzy pink bird with the. I saw a big yellow bird with fuzzy pink feet. What did you see? A fuzzy pink bird with the yellow feet. Oh yeah, all right." And they go right back to it. So, that's a great, great bit. I love the scene where they go and Hawkeye and Trapper confront Frank and Hot Lips at her tent, and she has that vibrator.
Yes.
On, which is, you know, that's something that, of course, vibrators now only have really one connotation. But back then, they had other, you know, there were other forms of them. And I love that they give Margaret a salute, knowing she'll return it out of habit. And, of course, she does with the vibrator strapped to her hand, which is a great – they know her too well.
Major, I think your salute is idling a little too fast.
Yeah. That's great. Now, of course, Frank arrests – Hawkeye and Trapper, and he puts them in the tent with just their boxers on, which is completely illegal because they haven't done anything wrong. Like, you can't arrest them for nothing.
He did that out of fear that they would actually go and kind of dismiss all of his cases. Because yes, even though Henry was in army, he still ran the hospital efficiently. And I think, you know, deep in the back of Frank's mind, he knew that part. And he would be afraid that Henry would come back.
Right. I mean, he can tell them you can't leave camp, but he can't arrest them. I mean, for God's sake, which just shows you that, again, you give Frank a little bit of power and he goes completely insane. And I like all the stuff between Alan Alda and Wayne Rogers about, you know, there's no still. I'm tickling my clothes and your knees are driving me wild. And Trapper says something
like,
I'm easy, but I'm not cheap. They have that great rapport with each other. And then, they get Klinger to put a Mickey in the beer, and they give the beer to the MP Playboy Roy Goldman. And I have to wonder, like, you see the guy, the MP drink the beer, right? He takes one sip and he falls over maybe 3 seconds later. What the hell is in that beer, man? That is a powerful sedative.
Yeah, I have a few. I tried to actually pause that scene where Trapper gives Klinger the prescription, and you could actually see on the prescription there's three lines. I can't make out the second line, but it does say "give the guard," and then whatever that second line says, phenobarbital.
Does it really? Wow! Yeah. Oh, that's funny. I've never known. I never looked that closely. That's great.
Yeah, I tried pausing it when he's handing the prescription for the nasal drip, and I paused it just at the right spot, and I think it might say an explicit on it just to get, you know, see if Jamie Farr would kind of get rattled by it, but I don't think he does. And it just says, "give him some phenobarbital." And that's what he put in the beer. But I used to work in pharmaceuticals. Phenobarbital wouldn't take effect that quick.
Right, right. It's like, I always figured that if you, in a show like this, if you gave somebody a drug that powerful, that it could knock them on their ass within 3 seconds of digesting it, you really can't have somebody like Klinger giving it to them.
No.
Like, that has to be prescribed by a doctor, because that could very clearly kill you if it's prescribed just a little too heavy. I mean, I was like, I mean, I know I'm not taking it too seriously. It's a gag. It's meant to be that, you know, you just, the way that he just falls out of the frame. But I just, even as a kid, I was like, wow, that's some strong stuff, man. That guy barely got it into his stomach before he's already passed out.
Yeah. There's a part at the end of that exchange where I kind of also have to wonder too. There's a part where Hawkeye says to Klinger, "take two bras out of petty cash." And I don't know if it's me or if Jamie Farr is he is an incredible actor, but I don't know. It seems to me like Alan Alda kind of ad-libbed that line, because if you look at Jamie Farr's face, he kind of like, really? What? What the hell just happened? And he's like turning around trying to figure out what to do next. And then the scene cuts and on to the next. The comedic timing of Alan Alda just really makes that character. Also, you know, some of the more serious parts too down the line, but especially in the first three seasons, a lot of his laughing, it just seems so genuine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you could really see it within his character. I think it's the whole cast really just does a great job of this entire episode.
Yeah, he liked to throw in little gags on to Klinger and stuff. And there's another line that seems a little like an aside where they get Meg Craddy to show up, and she has that powerful speech about, you know, the helping Henry Blake is helps people. There's more I can say for you, high price bellhops, which is a great dig at them. And then Hawkeye leans into her and he's like, you know, you're beautiful. And she says, I used to be, Sonny. I love that he flirted with her a little. And that's even something they continued on in the second episode where Meg Craddy came back. The season four episode, the kids, and Hawkeye kind of flirts with her there too, which is really cute. Again, I'm sure it's in the script, but it's just the way Alda delivers it. It feels like an aside that he just thought of, which is always great because it makes it seem like it seems so genuine. A couple things worth mentioning about these actors, of course. The actress that played Meg Craddy, I mentioned, is Hope Summers. She was in a couple of real classics. She's in Rosemary's Baby.
Yes.
She was in Inherit the Wind, which is one of my favorite movies of all time. She was in Foul Play, and she died in 1979. This is one of her, not last credits, but she didn't have too many after this. The other movie she's famous for was the movie Zero Hour, and some of you may be wondering, what's Zero Hour? Well, Zero Hour was a thriller about pilots who get sick on an airplane in the middle of a flight, and it is that movie that the Zucker brothers turned into Airplane. Yes. They literally just took that film and turned it into a comedy, and that's what it is. So she's in that movie. The actress who plays the Korean refugee, the pregnant girl, her name is Honani Min, and she has an extraordinary list of credits. She died in 2014, so she died pretty young, but she racked up a lot of amazing credits, including a lot of cool genre stuff. She did voices on Superman the Animated Series, Batman the Animated Series, Superpowers Galactic Guardians. She appeared in V, Lois and Clark. She was also on the shows Tour of Duty and China Beach, where the two most direct descendants of MASH. And she made return appearances on MASH itself. She was in The Kids, the other Meg Craddy episode. Yep. And she plays the North Korean quasi-assassin in Gorilla My Dreams from season 8. Another great episode. And weird fact, she was married to Mark Singer, the Beastmaster. So she had kind of an interesting life. Now, she doesn't have any lines here. She just shows up as a sort of a prop. But nevertheless, I'm always – when I research these episodes, I always kind of figure, if I'm not familiar with somebody, I'm like, oh, I wonder how many credits they've had. And then I look at her and she's got like dozens and dozens. I'm like, wow, good for her. She really, you know, had quite a career after this show. And, you know, you mentioned at the top about McLean Stevenson. And I've said this in other episodes, and I think we've even talked about it. I think I talked about it with Ryan over on Cheerscast regarding Shelley Long, in that McLean Stevenson's career was not really very good after he left MASH. You know, he just did a bunch of really kind of cruddy shows, Hello Larry and stuff like that. And he never and in a lot of ways, his career kind of became a joke because he was like famous for a guy. This is a guy that left a hit show and never did anything any good after that. And that might be the case. But clearly, when given the right material, McLean Stevenson could deliver because he was great as Henry Blake. He was just great. And I love – there's two moments in this episode that I absolutely love. And again, one of them has to be because he wrote the script, is when General Mitchell really harangues him and says, you know, don't you have anything to say in your defense? And McLean Stevenson or Henry just says, I was only trying to help. And there's this long beat on General Mitchell with no dialogue. And I have to figure that was maybe either the work of Gene Reynolds, who was the producer who maybe helped edit it, or the director, Don Weiss, who did 15 other episodes of MASH. But I love the way it hangs on General Mitchell. Like it just it starts to sink in on him the way Henry says, I was just trying to help. I really love that moment.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. And then the other moment that I love is when – you know, when he's on trial, Henry is a bumbler and he's stumbling over his words and he's clunking heads with Radar and he knocks his papers onto the floor. And there's all the double talk about Major Houlihan, according to him, she's a he. Who is? He is. He's a her. Yeah, like all that nonsense talk, which is very funny. But I love it when after Meg Craddy arrives, Henry stands up and he has that speech about, you know, before Meg Craddy came along, you know, 7 out of 10 babies born to the Hill people died in the first week. And he's like, I never denied our boys of one thing. And he's like, yeah, I'm guilty. So you can throw hang my butt from a firing squad or whatever. And I love that in that moment, like Henry transforms.
Yeah.
You know, he becomes that powerful, strong leader. And you're like, wow, when it's about medicine, Henry's the man, you know, he really can do it. It's only when he's caught up in the army bureaucracy that he seems like such a clown.
And McLean Stevens was very good at doing that too, because you see it in a couple other episodes where when it comes to any other ranking officers that are above him, that's trying to, you know, get at him, he gets all bumbled and just stumbles along the way. But when he's with, you know, the MASH crew at the 477th, he's just trying to be one of the guys. But when he needs to, he can put down his foot and just be that hospital administrator that they need. And that backbone to his character comes through.
Yeah.
Very well.
Yeah, it's a nice big close-up of McLean Stevenson. He's like, no money changed hands. I'm guilty, you know? And he really is really great in this episode. And again, it's he wrote the script about himself, which is, you know, I mean, he knew he had to deliver, and he did. I think it was just really great. One thing I can't help but notice is when Frank and Hot Lips arrive, who's left at the hospital?
I was going to bring that up too. They left. Hawkeye and Trapper are there. Henry Blake's been there. Who's running the place?
Be anybody show up that needs medicine.
I know. You would think with Frank's paranoia and everybody's trying to take over, he would leave himself or Margaret there.
I mean, I'm literally thinking, who is in charge? I guess it's like Nurse Kelly or something. I guess she's like the next highest ranked person back at the 477. I mean, like, you can't do that.
It's not like regimental was, you know, a 5-minute drive down the road.
Yeah, I know.
You had to travel back to Seoul. And geographically, Weishangbu and Seoul are not that close together. So who's at the camp?
Yeah. It's like, I guess they left the keys with Nurse Kelly, and they're like, all right, let's hope everything works out. And then finally, the gag that ends the episode where Burns refuses to drop the charges, and then Hawkeye and Trapper come up with the idea, or Hawkeye comes up with it, and he's writing the piece of paper, and you see the Trapper's reading it, and he laughs, and he's, what's the new evidence? And it's the whole thing about that they're going to rat Burns out to his wife. Why don't they just do that every time? Like every time Frank pulled that nonsense, I would just use that as he's got that sword of Damocles constantly over his head. I would never not use that threat.
Yeah, and what does Margaret care? I mean, it's not like she knows that Frank is married. She knows Frank's married. It's not like she doesn't know it. But what does she care if Frank or if Mrs. Burns finds out? I mean, she wants to be with him anyway.
Yeah, it doesn't.
This is your ticket. Don't care.
This again. These episodes were kind of never meant to be watched in clumps. You know, they never thought they were meant to be watched week by week, and ostensibly you kind of forgot about them after you watched them, or at the very least you didn't remember the details. So they all sort of exist in their own little universe, and you know, this gets them out of the jam, and we'll worry about it next week. You know, why they can't just use it next week or whatever. But and then actors wise, two other things I wanted to mention: the actors that are flanking General Mitchell. The guy playing the major is Jack Aaron, who has a career all over the place. He was an actor. He was in this episode. He was in a bunch of other TV series. He was in the blaxploitation spy movie, The Spook Who Sat by the Door. He's also credited as the Marine Coordinator on Baywatch and as a production staffer on Lost. I don't know how your career goes all over the place like that, but it did. So, okay, good on you, Jack Aaron. And then the other guy, Fox, is played by an actor named Ralph Grosch. He had credits on Batman, and he actually plays the same character in Officers Only. He's basically Lieutenant Mitchell's sort of right-hand man. He only has the one line. He says, we'll get to that in a moment. But so those are the other actors in this episode. And then did you notice that there is a repeat of a joke from a previous episode in this one?
I did not.
When they are back at the camp, there's a the PA announcer says the following people have volunteered for the 10-mile hike, and then there's no names. Yes. That's the same joke from season one. I don't know why they felt the need to layer in an extra joke and why it would be announced in the middle of the night or whatever, but nevertheless, there it is. So just
now that you bring that up, I do. Yes.
Yeah, it makes no sense. it makes no sense at all. But you know, okay, I guess they felt the need. We don't want all the silence or something. So, in terms of this episode, do you have a particular favorite joke?
I do. It goes back to when they walk into the tent and Margaret's massaging Frank's face, and Hawkeye says, "I've always said it. Behind every great man, there's a woman with a vibrator." It just every time, because that joke is kind of. The meaning of that joke could change into any direction you wanted to.
Yeah.
But being that he calls it a vibrator, and this is back in the 70s, you can get away kind of with things like that because that machine had different uses.
Right.
Now,
right.
Today, when people say, oh, a vibrator, you kind of go in one direction.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just, every time, I've seen all these episodes countless times, and every time I see it, I just start laughing. It just, it never loses its touch, and... I love that. I actually, a lot of these shows, I use some of these, one-liners in my life when I'm talking to friends or whatever, and I've used that a lot. And it always gets a laugh, no matter what.
I am not going to look this up on Google, but I am sort of wondering, like, do they still make those other kinds, Like, whatever that little, that first of all.
It was quite clunky.
It looks very clunky. It looks heavy because it looks like it's made of metal.
Yeah.
So it looks like it probably – I mean, she has it on her – and you can apparently, like, put your – like, almost wear it like a ring because you can, like, wrap it around your finger or whatever. So, yeah, I don't – I'm not going to Google it because I know what results I'm going to get. Yeah, so, okay,
something's
yeah.
Something's going to come up in that.
Yeah, exactly.
Looks like a little carburetor.
Yeah, it does look – it does. Yeah, it really does look like something you'd see in an engine block.
Yeah.
My favorite line, actually, of all the great lines in this episode is actually belongs to the aforementioned Fox, is when General Mitchell says, I'd invite you all to the officers' club, but it doesn't open for another hour. And Fox says, I've got the key, General. And Mitchell, delighted, says, Fox, put yourself down for a Silver Star.
Yeah.
It's like – such an insult to the people that actually got Silver Stars for bravery that you would get a Silver Star for having a key to the Oak Club.
It's like it's just something that, only they can get away with.
Yeah. That line just makes me laugh. Sorry. Fox, put yourself down for a Silver Star. And the way Robert F. Simon delivers it is perfect. It's just great. So, yeah, that line makes me laugh every time I hear it. So, yeah, the Trial of Henry Blake is a – I find myself saying this every episode for this season of MASH, but I think it's true. I don't think they've had a bad episode in season two. They don't have one. So I'm going to repeat myself and be like, well, this is a great episode because it is. I mean, they just – as of season two, I think they just hit the ground running and they managed to find different approaches, different ideas. I mean, this episode is unique and, of course, most of it takes place off camp. So, and it's – as you say, it's not a medical show. Other than the the situation itself, but there's no surgery scenes or anything like that, and yet they still made it compelling, and it's got a little bit of verisimilitude in that, of course, at some point Henry would have to answer for what he does. He can't just get as good as the 477th is, and they say it has like a 98% survival rate. At some point, the military is going to be clamping down on this.
Yeah.
Especially with the majors that are constantly sending in reports and poking and trying to poke the hornet's nest. So I just think it's a complete winner. And again, all credit to the late, great McLean Stevenson for writing this episode because he just crushed it.
Absolutely. This one was hit out of the ballpark. And to me, I have two of my favorite episodes of the entire show comes out of this season. And this is one of them. And it's just one that I always go back to that no matter what – I typically like to watch these episodes in order. But if I just want to watch one episode, this is one of the four or five I go back to and just watch. It's just that great. And no matter how many times I've seen it, this episode just doesn't lose its touch.
Yeah, it's a really, really great episode. And then the last thing I'll mention is a little bit of like fun fact trivia in that in the MASH reunion show, the first one, there were two. The first one, Memories of MASH, the one hosted by the aforementioned Shelley Long.
Yes.
They talk about how MASH was translated across many, many countries I mean, it wasn't just popular in America. It played all over the world. And the example they use is they show you a scene from a MASH episode translated into like six different languages. So they show you the same scene over and over and over, but in a different language. And it's a scene from this episode. And it's the one where Henry does the speech and then Radar pops out from behind Hawkeye and he goes, right. And they show you that scene five times, like once where you hear Gary Berghoff, Radar talking in like Italian and then talking in Japanese and then talking. And so, and it's all the different versions. And so that's the episode they picked from, is that little thing of him just popping out from behind Hawkeye. So yes. And so this is a total winner. So I think that is going to do it. So Tim, thank you so much for stopping by. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I had a great time.
Well, thank you. I said I appreciate everybody listening to the show, and I appreciate you reaching out and wanting to come on for season two. So this has just been great. So thanks, everybody, for listening. Of course, if you want to follow MASHcast, you want to subscribe, you can go to the website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can leave a comment there. You can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts and on Stitcher. And we're always talking MASH over on Twitter, which is as at MASH477cast. And make sure you're watching the show on Hulu. It's still available on Hulu. Make sure Hulu knows that you're interested in MASH. So if you're interested in watching MASH, watch it on Hulu. So I guess that is going to do it. So until the next week, that is all.
Blake is unfit to command.
We love him. Hard cheese. This outfit is finally going to have a real man in charge.
Oh, good luck, fella. You deserve it, guy.
Oh,